This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week we're going to wrap up our two-part conversation we had with Richard Hatch when we were at the 2019 Magi Fest over in Columbus, Ohio. Last week he was talking about several things, including the formation of H&R Magic Books, as well as his search for S.W. Erdenace, the mysterious author of Expert at the Card Table. This week he concludes that last little part. In fact, in order to get back into our chat, I spend a minute or two kind of getting you caught up with the last couple of minutes of where we ended last week. So this way that you have more of a seamless transition and you remember kind of where we were as we ended that conversation there last week. Well, he does complete that part of the conversation having to do with Erdenace and then goes on into some additional people he has been researching, including Washington Simmons, among other magicians who are really unknown to at least me and perhaps many of you out there as well. So I find this really fascinating because they were quite some notable people, I guess, of their time back in the 1800s when they had traveled through Salt Lake City and had brushed shoulders with Brigham Young, who was with the Mormon faith, the religion, and they're in Salt Lake City. Anyhow, it's very fascinating as to some of the things that had happened, and also one of the things that Richard talks about on the podcast is a pair of boots that I believe Brigham Young was wearing, and a trick that was played on him, supposedly, and his boots are actually, he sent me a photo of those boots that he took when he was there at their museum or temple. And anyhow, that's on the website at themagicwordpodcast.com. A lot of stuff we're going to talk about and cover here this week, and it's always a pleasure to talk with Dick because he is really a fountain of knowledge when it comes to just about anything when it comes into magic history. So I hope you guys can learn something from him again this week. So please welcome my guest, Mr. Richard Hatch, here on The Magic Word.
The only move in the book that is named with his initials, and he makes reference to the fact that he put his initials on it. He says something like, I don't put my initials on this to appear big on the bills, but I just needed to give it a name. It's the SWE shift. Well, what David Alexander argues, if you shift those initials, if you take the SWE and you perform a shift, you can get to WES. It's like, oh, God, all right. Yeah. So it's kind of some, and he does similar things with the title page that, you know, if you move around and you look at the typography, and some of it ends up seeming kind of like, to an outsider at least, like a Bible code kind of thing. You know, you can get to anywhere from anything if you look at it closely enough. But it was really smart and a really good presentation, and it caused some buzz. So his, I had already agreed to write it up for. John Mooring was at that time editor of Magic, and so I had done a number of things for him. So he grabbed me to write up my story for that, for the, I think it was the December issue of Magic. This happened in November. It might have been the January. I think it was the December issue, though. And Jeannie got David Alexander to write up his for an issue of Jeannie.
Separate,
that came out
sure.
right after that. And it was the cover story of Jeannie. It has David Alexander as a detective, an expert at the card table. And it really, again, if you're interested in the topic, you have to have both those, the Magic issue and the Jeannie issue. At the end of the Magic issue, by then I'd done enough research on E.S. Andrews to think, you know, he's more interesting to me than this attorney that I thought he was related to, who he probably isn't, but this Edwin Sumner Andrews, because I found out enough about him to say everything fits. He moves to Chicago at the time the book is published after that. He leaves Chicago when it drops in half price. He's in an interesting profession. He's a traveling a traveling agent, it's called, with the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. So it's a Chicago railroad. He's stationed in Denver. We have an Erdenace sighting in Denver. He goes to Chicago, another kind of gambling center in 1903, I think. So he moves to Chicago from Denver. Then he moves, but he was in Chicago in the 1890s when we think Erdenace was in Chicago. Goes to Denver, goes back to the Chicago area, goes to San Francisco. That's when the book drops in half price, maybe. And the real thing that really sold me on this at the time was the first company to advertise at half price is a very obscure magic company, the Atlas Trick and Novelty Company, which was in Chicago on something called, and I may get this just slightly wrong, but it's critical, unfortunately, if it is wrong. He was either on Austin Avenue or Austin Boulevard. And lo and behold, my guy, when he lives in Chicago, is living on the opposite. So let's say Atlas was on Austin Avenue. My guy's living on Austin Boulevard. I assumed it was the same street. And mm-hmm. and in fact, my guy was living in an enclave of Chicago called Oak Park, and where Hemingway had was from, and the Edgar Rice Burroughs that wrote the Tarzan books of Frank Lloyd Wright. That was a little wealthy enclave of Chicago, but surrounded on all sides by Chicago. If you go, you know, a half a mile north, you're back in Chicago on that same avenue, and that's where I assumed that the reason that company, Magic Company, got these books is because he could walk
just close by
up the street.
Sure.
And well, Bill Mullins, who's a terrific researcher, at some point figured out there are two streets. One is Austin
and
Boulevard,
they're not nearby.
And then they're not the same.
Okay,
by then I was sold on my guy, so it was too late. And since then, you know, and so that's one strike against my guy. Since then, Bill has found, you know, one of the problems with Canada is, can you put a deck of cards in the sands? Well, he found an article in a San Francisco newspaper about my guy, where he's turning down playing in a poker game. He finds an excuse to get out of a poker game. Mm-hmm. That's almost putting a deck of cards in his hand. They wouldn't ask him to play if they didn't have some kind of history of play.
Sure.
And it turns into kind of a funny anecdote. He says, "I can't. I got to go down to San Jose to check out. I got to check out the Pippins, which is kind of an apple." And when he's he can't do it because he can't play in their poker game because he's checking out the Pippins. He's spotted in the red light district in San Francisco with a couple of gals on his arms, and the newspaper article says, "Ah, we know what Pippins you're talking about." You know, it's that kind of a silly story. But so that kind of puts a deck of cards in his hand. And he dies in 1928 when the book needed to be copyrighted and all kinds. So he's just a great circumstantial fit, but there's no smoking gun for him. Since then, several other candidates really interesting have come up. Peter Zenner has one that I think is really interesting. A guy that wrote articles for the Sphinx under his stage name has a writing style that some people think is very similar to the books. Mm-hmm. And he hasn't published his work yet. Some of you can read on the Genie Forum in that long Erdnase thing.
Yep, it's very long thread.
Chris Wasserhuber has an ebook about his candidate, and he's totally convinced this is the guy, case closed. It's a guy named Edward Galloway who is in the right places at the right time, you know, and if you want someone at the scene of the crime, this guy is there. He's mm-hmm. working for the company that we strongly, strongly believe printed the book. The book was copyrighted by S.W. Erdnase, care of this printing company, James McKinney and Company, printers in Chicago. So there was obviously some kind of relationship
right.
there. Probably printed the book for him and maybe even had it bound. And this guy was working for that company at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So he had that relationship. And the critical clue is he had a copy of the first edition in his library. Now, it's not signed, "Yeah, this is my book, you know, I'm the author," or anything. But, you know, why would a guy that worked for the printer have a copy of that book?
Right.
Now, maybe he had
right.
copies of all the books that he worked on. We don't know what the rest of his library was like. But Chris has done a tremendous amount of research on his candidate and making a strong case that why he's the guy.
He's the guy. Has library.com.
Library yeah. with okay. a Y, library.com, and it's available there. And I highly recommend it if you're interested in that topic.
So who's your guy?
I my favorite is still, probably because I found him, and so I'm partial to him, is this Edwin S. Andrews, a train agent.
Mm-hmm.
I can't put him in a bottom-dealing position.
Yeah.
We have that one connection to the game he turned down. But he's a great circumstantial fit. He seems to be the right height from the one photograph I have. His kids and his wife are all taller than he is
okay.
From that photo. He's in all the right places at all the right times.
Right.
But it's a circumstantial case. There's
gotcha.
Nothing more than that. But he's a great fit.
So it's still ongoing. It's an interesting detective.
It is, and it may never be known. And that's
yeah.
probably part of the fun. It's kind of disappointing if we find out it's Joe Schmo.
So you have done a lot of research, obviously, on who your favorites are, and that's kind of evolved and talked about Erdnase and who other people think that it is and all that. I assume that you're continuing to keep up with other research, particularly since you've moved to Utah. You probably have a little bit more time on your hands since you're not selling books as much as you were
right,
from
that's
before.
True. That's true. And I have been, and, you know, there are new resources all the time. All these newspapers are being digitized, and you have to keep checking because new ones get added.
Mm-hmm.
Just about a week ago, I found a new reference to my guy, E.S. Andrews, that he was working in like 1918, 1919. He was the agent, no longer for trains, he was the agent for an apple exporting company. Uh-huh. His office was in Watsonville, California. And I knew he'd changed to the apple business because he had an apple orchard himself. Again, ties in maybe to the Pippin story. I didn't know that he worked for that particular company. It was a company based out of Boston, but he was their California agent. Found an advertisement in a newspaper. It was a magazine or publication for the packing industry. And there he was. And it's definitely the same guy. Mm-hmm. Doesn't add to whether he was Erdnase or not, but it gives me another point on his lifetime. If he is the guy, then we know a little bit more about him biographically. It doesn't rule him in or out. But it was interesting to me that there was another, you know, I'm sure there's lots more that could be found out about all these guys. And at some point, you know, you can try and connect the dots and say this is our best guy so far. Todd Carr has had several interesting candidates, including one named E.S. Andrews, who spent jail time in the Midwest and had a Chicago connection. For a while, Todd and I both thought, hey, that's probably my guy, and explained some gaps in his timeline. Now it's likely that his guy is not my guy, a different E.S. Andrews, but we don't even know if that's the guy's real name. We don't know his first name or his middle name. We just know his initials, and he kind of disappears. So I don't know the current state of Todd's research on that, and he has other candidates that he's proposed that he's researched extensively. But so there are always new guys popping up that are viable and interesting. So I think it's, you know, part of what keeps it interesting is it's an unsolved mystery.
Yeah, and fascinating.
Yeah.
So there are other people you're researching?
Well, since I like taking advantage of local resources, and since we moved to Utah, I've done several presentations on the history of magic in Utah. The Mormon pioneers came to Utah in 1847 and populated as best they could the state. And then the transcontinental train arrived in May 10th of 1869. So they're celebrating the 150th anniversary this coming May 10th. Going to make a big to-do about that in Utah. And that changed things. You know, traveling magicians came through before there were trains, but it was really a challenge. You'd have to, you know, cross the prairie if you're coming from the east, or the mountains if you're coming from the west. But several people did.
It wasn't a plain state by any means. Yeah,
no.
It's a hardship.
It was really challenging. Yeah.
Willard did with his traveling show. It would have been a lot more difficult to travel through.
Yeah, he had at least trucks and roads and that kind of stuff. He'd set up his own theater in the tent, which is a different kind of challenge that you got to admire and respect. Remember when we went to see Tihanyi? I think that's kind of what Willard, he had his own tent there at that Gulfgate Mall or whatever it was.
It was Gulfgate, and he came out on a
Rolls Royce, rode on the stage. Yeah,
pretty. I'll never forget that.
And they had the dancing fountains and stuff. Yes. Yeah, pretty amazing. Anyway, so the first magician to come through, serious magician, traveling, you know, big magician to make a splash, is a guy named Washington Simmons. And he came through in February of 1864, so 5 years before the train connection came. And
he would have been one of the Civil War magicians, I guess.
It was during the Civil War.
Yeah. But he'd been traveling through other places trying to keep
Give you a little of his backstory. Let me start with this, though. Okay, here's kind of where he first appears in public consciousness in Utah. So Salt Lake was a city by then. They'd come in 1847. This is the 1860s. They were busy, they'd built streets and churches and other structures. They hadn't finished the famous temple that probably took them another 20 years to complete, I'm guessing. And they hadn't finished the tabernacle, which is also quite famous on Temple Square. They had a different tabernacle at that time. But they had completed a theater. In March of 1862, they built a theater that had seats for 1,500 people. Wow. And by all accounts, it was the best theater west of the Mississippi, you know, better than places in San Francisco and other bigger cities. Mm-hmm. Brigham Young thought, there's a famous quote of his. Now, Brigham Young, just to give it context, because not everybody knows, he was the Mormon prophet, the president of the church, who, after their founding prophet, Joseph Smith, was martyred in Illinois, Brigham Young took most of the adherents to the faith, because it's split up into several groups. There's several different Mormon sects.
The golden
sects,
plates or whatever were given to
the golden plates.
Smith.
He claims to have translated their primary resource, which they call the Book of Mormon. He translated that from golden plates, which were given him to him by an angel, the angel Moroni, and they were written by someone named Mormon, so that's why it's the Book of Mormon. And they, I hope I'm not telling this story wrong, because I'm not as knowledgeable about the theology as I probably should be, having been raised in that faith and descended from Mormon pioneers myself. It's basically in the views of believers, it's a companion volume to the Old and New Testament. And in their belief, it's the story, first of two lost tribes of Israel that came from the Middle East, I guess Jerusalem essentially, over to the New World and populated the New World. So their belief is that the Native Americans are descended from these lost tribes of Israel.
Gotcha.
And then it's the story of how Jesus, after his resurrection, appeared to the Native Americans, and so that they would have the gospel as well.
Right, here.
And there's a lot of interesting. Again, I'm an outsider. I don't have
You're
that
a practicing
conviction.
Mormon, yeah.
I'm not. But they have funded a lot of archaeological research on topics that are faith promoting for them. So, like in South America, one of the reasons the conquistadors had success is some of the Incas and Aztecs, the native populations, were expecting a white bearded god to return. And here's Pizarro. He's white. He's bearded. It must be him.
Must be him.
Well, that fits into the Jesus story, coming back or second coming, whatever. So there's a lot of they've funded a lot of research on that and been very successful in having proselytizing among South American countries, because it taps into that. And,
right.
and so it's a whole story of these two tribes. They call them the Lamanites and the Nephites, who are fighting. One is good, one is bad, and it's their whole history. Anyway, how do we get on?
So
that?
We're talking about the theater that had 1,500 seats.
Right,
it was 19,
there we go.
1862.
Let's get back to it. So Brigham Young is kind of the American Moses, and there was a biography. He took this people across the plains from Illinois and then Omaha. They spent a winter in Omaha and then took them across the plains. And continued to bring more and more people. They had missionaries all over the world, especially in England, that were converting people who would come over and come to Utah. Yeah, and they would help finance their trip and everything. And Brigham Young was the president of the church and the prophet whose word was when he said so. Not everything he said is the word of God, but he would have revelations and say, this is what the Lord. And so they believe in, they're called the Latter-day Saints, because they believe there are still saints today and the God still speaks to us. Not everything he wanted to say was in the Old and the New Testament. So anyway, enough theology. So that's who Brigham Young was.
Right.
And what most people know that know anything about him is that he practiced what they prefer to call plural marriage, more commonly called polygamy, had multiple wives. And there's a lot of speculation about how many wives he had. Now you can go to Wikipedia and find out exactly how many wives he had.
Yeah.
I did that and was shocked to discover that my great-great-great-grandmother became his 48th wife in 1855. Who knew?
Wow.
I'm not descended from him. She was a widow by then. I'm descended from her first husband.
Yeah. Okay.
I didn't know Grandma married the prophet, one of many who did. But her son, who I am descended from, Hiram B. Clausen, practiced plural marriage himself. I'm descended from his second wife, an actress, Margaret Gay Judd Clausen, but his third and fourth wives were daughters of Brigham Young. So I have, third cousins who are descended from the prophet.
Funny.
But it's curious to me. I didn't know I knew that. I knew that he had been Brigham Young's stepson. That's often son-in-law. But I didn't know he had been Brigham Young's stepson from his mom. Becoming the 48th wife. Anyway.
So the theater, they still have.
Back to the theater.
Yeah.
So he built the Salt Lake Theater. And given, they couldn't bring in stuff for it. It had parquet seating and dress boxes and three tiers and seated 1,500, which was the population of the whole city was probably 10 to 15,000 at the time it was built. So you could get, a tenth of the population in there at a time. So that opened in March of 1862, but it was almost all the events there were hosted by the local drama association. They would put on plays on Wednesdays and Saturdays and went through the Shakespeare cycle and all kinds of stuff. And, and they did bring in some out-of-town actors, a couple
like
called—
Like
These were actors. They were, so it wasn't bringing through variety artists.
Okay.
Yeah, that happened. The first one that came through was a lecturer, a humorist. He's regarded as America's first stand-up comedian, a guy named Artemus Ward. He was traveling from San Francisco to New York, and he decided to stop in Salt Lake. And Washington Simmons. And Simmons comes up in the newspaper. There was a newspaper being published by the Army was stationed there to kind of keep a lid on the Mormons, who were viewed, possibly rightly so, as a very unusual kind of cult group that might be a threat to, you know, the
National
Union.
Security.
Yeah, exactly.
Time.
You got to keep a lid on things there. And so they had something called Camp Douglas. Now it's Fort Douglas. Which was above Salt Lake. Now it's part of Salt Lake, because Salt Lake, of course, has grown up around it. It's right by University of Utah, part of the University of Utah, actually. Anyway, so the Army was stationed there, a couple of thousand troops, and they had their own theater. But Salt Lake Brigham Young built this theater. And my great-great-grandfather, Hiram B. Clausen, his son-in-law, was also his personal secretary and one of his financial managers. He was put in charge of building the theater. He wasn't the architect, but he got the supplies and paid for the goods. And he became the first manager of the theater and acted in many of their productions because he'd been an actor before that and still was very interested in that. But so, Brigham Young is widely quoted to having said that a people need entertainment as well as religion. And religion, you know, you can build the church first, but the second thing you build is a theater. He would often attend the performances, and he'd been an actor himself.
Until 1864 was when.
So 2 years later. It hadn't quite been open 2 years. And in the newspaper, on February 4th, 1864, a little notice appears in a corner of the newspaper that was published by the soldiers. It wasn't, the Mormon newspaper was not being published during this period because of a newsprint shortage. But and this was the first daily paper in Utah, was published by the soldiers, the California Volunteers, who were itching to go fight in the Civil War, but they were stuck in Utah, unfortunately. So they put out a newspaper to keep busy.
Yeah.
And there's a little ad in the corner of the February 4th edition that says, Simmons, the Basilicon Tomaturgist, is coming. That's all it said.
Okay.
Yeah, what the heck is a Basilicon Tomaturgist? On that same page, in the lower corner, the opposite, the lower left corner, is a little article called the Basilicon the Basilicon Tomaturgist says, can you read it? Can you spell it? Think not. What does it mean? And it explains, this is this guy's a magician, and he's just arrived here. And from his notice that's up in the other corner, he's probably going to put on a show, probably at the Salt Lake Theater. So keep your eyes open for future announcements. They'd actually announced his arrival 2 days earlier with a little article about how he pulled eggs out of someone's beard. And, you know, this guy was going to make a custard with the eggs, but then the eggs had disappeared and were back in the magician's pocket. And in that, they mention that he was in the company of Artemus Ward. So now we have to get some background on who is this Artemus Ward. So as I mentioned, he was America's first stand-up comedian. He'd been a journalist, and then he started to write satirical things. He'd created a character called Artemus Ward. His real name was Charles Farrer Brown. But he created this persona that he claimed to write as, who was a traveling showman who had a bunch of wax figures who he would travel from town to town and put on these shows. But
portable wax museum.
Yeah, that's what he claimed to have. Now, that's a fictitious character that he invented to do these satirical pieces on. And in 1860, and he was very popular, in fact, so popular that Abraham Lincoln in 1862 also, I may be off on the dates, but check Wikipedia, before presenting the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet, he made them sit through a reading that Lincoln did of one of Artemus Ward's satirical pieces.
Funny.
And they were thinking, what are we doing here? And Lincoln apparently was upset that they didn't think it was as funny as he did. And he said, gentlemen, you know, we must lighten the mood in these desperate times. You know, if you can't laugh, you can't live, that kind of thing. Anyway,
yeah. So
Lincoln was a huge fan, obviously, of Artemus Ward, and that's one of his footnotes to fame as having been
Lincoln's favorite comedian.
We'll call him that. Yeah, we'll say Lincoln's favorite comedian, humorous writer. And he had a collection of his works called Artemus Ward, his book published, and it was a huge bestseller at the time, 40,000 copies, I think, in its, you know, first couple of months, which is a huge, you know, that's nothing today for Hillary.
But it's huge
numbers, yeah. So very successful. And then he started doing lectures. Now, he didn't look at all like his fictional character, and he didn't pretend to be his fictional character in these talks. He spoke as himself, but people thought it was hilarious. One of his famous talks, and this is the one that he was arranged to give in Salt Lake, was called The Babes in the Wood. It had nothing to do with babes or wood. It was all kinds of other stuff. And, you know, about an hour into it, he'd look at his watch and said, oh, my goodness, I guess we better talk at the about the babes in the wood. But, you know, we're out of time. You can go home, look it up in the encyclopedia. You know, he'd go off on it. It was part of the joke was he never talked about
what
the
subject
matter. And it even says, you know, in the advertisements, you know, he's giving his comical oration, The Babes in the Woods, in which he talks about various things and may occasionally allude to his topic, that kind of thing. He had arrived.
It's kind of like what we're doing. We're beating around the bush.
Yeah, we're going down so many I apologize. We'll get there. We'll get there eventually.
And so next time on the podcast, we'll talk about.
Yeah. No. This is the Artemus Ward Hour. So Artemus Ward and a guy named E.P. Hingston, who was an Englishman, who was his manager, they had left New York, gone by boat through the down to Panama. Then there was no Panama Canal. They had to cross the isthmus on by train or whatever you did at the time, mules, got on a boat on the Pacific side, went up the coast to California, and got booked there. And it was here's how successful he was. His first lecture netted him $1,700. It was a dollar a ticket, and they filled the place. They had people waiting in the streets.
It's like $100,000 or more today.
Huge numbers, yeah. Amazing amount of money. Then they booked at a second theater, the Metropolitan Theater, a few nights later. It was not as big a theater, but the expenses weren't as big, so they were very happy, and they got $800 from that. By the time he crossed the coast and got to New York, he apparently had $17,000 in gold, because this was gold rush days in California, that he deposited in a New York bank. A huge, you know, very popular, successful guy. So now, in 1860, he, as Artemus Ward, had published a piece in Vanity Fair, which he was editing at the time, called Artemus Ward Meets Brigham Young. He'd never met Brigham Young. He'd never been to Utah. He didn't know any Mormons. He just made it up. And like everybody at the time who thought this was a very strange cult group, you know, all these wives and stuff, it was silly. He made fun of them. And at the end, and he would write in a kind of a phonetic dialect. It's not the ordinary spellings. It's you got to sound it out. He wrote something like, I left there as soon as, talking about Salt Lake, which he'd never been to. I left there as soon as I could. It's a second Sodom and Gomorrah, and these I've never met as thieving and dishonest to people in my life. Something like that. I mean, really slamming them. But he didn't know. He was being silly. It was satirical, and people loved it because that's what they thought too. So now he's decided to go back to New York rather than going back through Panama. He's going to cross country. He's going to stop in Salt Lake, and if he can, he'll give a talk there. But he's, you know, they're not liking him because he's written this thing about him, and he's a little bit worried. So on the way, he does all kinds of stops at the mining towns in Nevada and gives shows. And he spends a couple of weeks in Virginia City. And on the newspaper there as a writer and editor was Samuel Clemens, later famous and already writing under the name Mark Twain. But no one knew him. He was not an entity. But he met Artemus Ward. And apparently, by his own admission, Mark Twain was inspired. He saw how successful and funny. He says Mark Twain writing later says he never saw anything as funny as Artemus Ward's talk on The Babes in the Wood. Just hilarious for him at the time. But they became good friends from that interaction. And Artemus Ward wrote him a letter from Salt Lake when he got there and on the way to Salt Lake. And those are preserved. And Mark Twain, when he decided to model himself on that career and become a lecturer and a comic lecturer himself, wrote to Hingston, Ward's former manager, saying, hey, would you manage me? And it didn't work out. Hingston, I think, was back in England by then. But there was a relationship there and definitely an inspiration. And Ward got Mark Twain's first really successful piece, The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, that was published in a New York publication thanks to Artemus Ward saying, talk to this guy and send it to him. He'll love it. And that gave him his literary start. Anyway, a little footnote to history there. While Ward and Hingston, Hingston again being the manager, and Hingston's very interesting too, he had been, prior to managing Artemus Ward, he had managed for about 10 years John Henry Anderson, the great Wizard of the North. And he'd managed him on a whole tour of Australia. Yeah. Then he'd brought him to the U.S. And unfortunately, it was bad timing. He's trying to travel and promote the great Wizard of the North during the Civil War. That's tough in the South. He was going to do shows in New Orleans. They don't want to, you know, it's like the guys that advertised no Confederates. They didn't mean, you know, that's
that's funny.
Wrong advertising. So Anderson goes back to England. Hingston hooks up with Artemus Ward and promotes him successfully. They start in San Francisco. Huge success. They start working through the mining camps. But while they're in San Francisco, the theater manager there, a guy named Wilder, at the Metropolitan Theater, he comes to them in their hotel room and says, "Say, boys, I got a guy who he could be a tremendous success if we could just advertise him properly. He's this magician. He just arrived here from Hong Kong and China and the East, Japan. He's really terrific, but he doesn't know the first thing about advertising." And Hingston, having, you know, even Houdini says, no, better than Barnum was John Henry Anderson. He would have his picture on pads of butter in the hotels, and he'd have guys in side. So he was a hero of Houdini's because he was such a terrific advertiser. And really, that was Hingston, a lot of it, building him up and making him a successful guy. So Hingston is the guy, if you want to advertise your show, get him to help. And they hear about it and they say, well, you know, we'd have to meet the guy. We don't know enough about him. But so they get introduced to this guy who's billing himself as Washington Simmons. He'd done a very successful tour of Australia and then gone to Hong Kong and then to Japan and then to Hawaii. And now he's in San Francisco. And Wilder, and this account is written up by Hingston, who wrote an autobiography of Artemus Ward after his friend and client passed away. It's called The Genial Showman. And there's a whole chapter about their encounter with this magician, Washington Simmons, although they don't give his name because they say, if he's still alive, we don't want to embarrass him because he might not appreciate what we're saying here.
Well, okay.
So they meet him, and they say, this guy's, you know, they don't say he's a terrific magician. In fact, to the contrary, they didn't think he was that great a magician, but they say he's a terrific BSer. They don't use that language, but you know, he's this guy's full of humbug, you know. And you know, if he can, in fact, Artemus Ward is quoted as saying, "Is you know, if you can force a card as well as he can tell lies, he's a great artist." You know, we'll help him out. Their agreement. They didn't get paid. They said, "Well, tell us the secret of this trick that you do," which was his blood red writing. It was a living and dead death. He'd have people write, you know, nine living people's names on little pellets, slips of paper, billets, and then one dead person's name, and they'd roll them up. And one at a time, he'd eliminate, you know, by psychic intuition, the live people's names. And then the dead name that was left over, he'd roll up his sleeves and rub it, and that name would appear in blood red writing on his arm. And that was his big, that was his signature piece at the time, the blood red writing on the arm. And so I said, tell us the secret of that, because Hingston had seen a psychic medium, a spiritualistic medium, a guy named Charles Forster, do that in Boston, and it fooled him. He didn't decide the guy was really psychic or a medium, but he didn't know how it worked. And and the other guy, Artemus Ward, says, hey, you know, if you tell me how the great Herman changes two rabbits into one rabbit, you know, I'll help you out too. So he did. He told him those tricks, and then he threw in the secret of the producing the goldfish bowls, and they're all written up in this chapter. So it's kind of a little expose. But the blood red writing is really interesting. Al Manlater reinvented the way of eliminating the names. How do you know which names are the dead names and which one, or the one dead name versus the live names? And you know, people will write very carefully when they're writing that dead name. The other names, they're just scrawling them out. So you look for the name that is they're going to be nine that are kind of similar handwriting, and one that is more careful, and that's the dead one. And that's kind of how he did add ways of accessing. Anyway,
that's not what I would have thought. There are other methods of doing that, you know.
That's what he told them, and it's a pretty sophisticated thing. Anyway, so they help him, and they come up with this, and they didn't come up with the name Basilicontometer. Just the theater manager said, we got to come up with a great, you know, we can't just call him a magician. We got to come up with something fancy, multisyllabic, and he's got to be a professor. I'm only going to hire a magician who's a professor. So the Washington Simmons says to them, well, while I was in Australia, someone called me a basilicontometrist. What do you think of that? And Artemus Ward says, that's fantastic. That's great. We'll call you. We'll stick with that. And the other guy, who was a little more illiterate, I guess, said, well, I'm not sure if the Greek is compounded properly. It turns out basilicon is Greek for royal, and tometergist is an illusionist, a wonder worker. So it'd mean the royal illusionist, and he was already billing himself as the king of the conjurers. So it works, and they stuck with it. So they're calling him now, you're going to be different from every other magician. You're the only basilicontometergist. And they write this. They saw his show. They write up a program in language that you cannot understand what he's doing, but it kind of fits in. And they thought, this will be great. It'll intrigue people. Well, I got to find out what that trick is. I'm going to go to the theater. So they create that for him. And then they say at the end of this chapter, talking about him, that they created a Frankenstein monster because he followed them, according to this account, Hingston's account, The Genial Showman, about Artemus Ward, that he followed them into the mining camps in crossing Nevada and California all the way to Salt Lake. But the problem was that you know, he would cover their playbills with his play, but he was, according to that account, playing in competition, and it was making them mad. And they say,
covering their bills, yeah.
Yeah. Finally, he says, Artemus Ward confronted him because they'd learned the secret to his big trick, and they said, look, if you don't, the country is not big enough for two basilicontometrists. If you don't stop doing that, I'm going to turn blood red rightist myself, and I'll be doing that in my lecture. And he said that after that, he kind of pulled back, but followed them all the way to Salt Lake. So Artemus Ward and Hingston show up in Salt Lake in early January, and they're going to do the show or want to do the show, but Artemus Ward becomes deathly ill. He almost dies, and so he's out of capacity for about 2 weeks. Meanwhile, Simmons catches up with him. He gets there by February 1st or 2nd. He's in the newspapers having arrived by February 2nd, so he got there a few days earlier. And by then, Artemus Ward is recovered and is arranged. He's met with Brigham Young on January 29th and made arrangements to perform in the theater. And as I say, he was a little bit worried because he'd written that satirical piece, and a Mormon emissary from the president comes and visits him and says, you know, the prophet's got your book. You shouldn't have poked fun at us. And he apologizes and says, you know, it was in fun. It was in jest. I didn't mean it. I'll write up the true story now that I know how nice you are. Helped me. Yeah. You nursed me back to health. And he was he writes to Mark Twain, the saints have been a godsend to me. They're wonderful. Anyway, so he gets use of the theater on February 8th, Monday night. And Simmons gets use of it on the 11th, the following Thursday. Meanwhile, the play that's in production is Othello. And they had two professional actors come from Denver for several months, for like a 6 months residency. So they're playing Iago and Desdemona, and a local actor is playing Othello. And after the Saturday, so they were Wednesdays and Saturdays were these plays. And on the Saturday night before the Monday and the Thursday that are coming up at Othello, it's advertised in the paper that after the performance, Professor Simmons will give a demonstration of his necromancy. Yeah, so mm-hmm. kind of a teaser performance. Yeah. And so he does. So he beats, he gets credit. He's the first traveling artist, showman, non-local, to put on a show there for that first.
So he beat out that guy by a couple
30
of days.
Minutes.
He must have upset him.
Well, I don't know. It's weird. In the same day that Othello performance is advertised, there is a performance, and I'm going to have to quote from this because it's so bizarre. That same day, there is an ad in the same paper for Washington Simmons, Professor Simmons, the great basilicontometrist, that says, here's what he's going to do. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read this from the program because there's no way I can get through it otherwise. So here's what it says. Professor Simmons, the basilicontometrist, will present the following Leviathan program at the Great Salt Lake Theater Thursday evening, February 11th, 1864. First, he will swallow a hayrick and put it back again alive. Second, he will squeeze himself through a stick of peppermint candy and afterwards suck it spirally. Third, he will freeze a red-hot stove, and when it is reduced to the constituency of warm tea, will set it again backwards on the same road. Fourth, he will inflate a rotary pump with one puff of his powerful windpipe and afterwards make it rise perpendicularly outwards, wind being north, south, east by west. Fifth, he will eat 9 oranges and lay 50 eggs out of them while flying, the stairs being carpeted and no questions asked. Sixth, he will take the inside of the theater out, pack it in a small envelope, swallow the envelope through his left ear, and when it is thoroughly drowned, and that could be a misprint for downed, he will put out the fire diagonally. Seventh, he will capsize himself vertically on a one-legged table and swallow an apple without it going down his throat. His esophagus will ascend, and his feet, looking from above upon himself, will gyrate chorally to the melody of a carboniferous lay in conical sections of the early history of Utah. And then NB, nota bene. Aesthetics will be strictly attended to, and the transcendental principles of art preserved with pre-Raphaelite simplicity. Eighth, he will cut off his head, severing the cervical vertebrae without regard to prime cost, put the whole in his pocket, and placing his left leg through his mouth, will walk forwards in a backward way, throwing himself to pieces and picking himself up again while cutting his cucumbers blue with lace edges.
Wow.
What is that all about? So
they just threw a lot of words together.
That came out
of
now, that's not the ad that in The Genial Showman they reprint. This is the ad we came up with him, and they reprint the whole thing. That's not it.
No.
That ad ran 3 days, and it's like, that's not stuff he can do. It doesn't even make sense.
3 days before a show, but 3 days before.
They ran it for 3 days. They ran it on the 6th, I think the 8th and the 9th, something like that, a few days before that. They ran it up until Artemus Ward did his show on the 8th, so it ran up through the 8th, so the 6th, 7th, and 8th or something like that. And then Artemus' show does his thing. And from the reports of his show, And the reviews of Simmons' show after Othello. One little irony, his show, they said, ran about a half an hour, and it was followed by a guy doing a sword dance while someone else played the bagpipes, like a Scottish, you know, you dance on the swords.
Okay.
And then a woman singing a song, and then which, you know, this is following Othello. How long is that? And they say at the end, you know, it was a great show, but it was about a half an hour too long. How long did Simmons perform? A half an hour. I don't know. I don't think that was necessarily a dig at him, but still, it's a overlong program. So Artemus Ward does his, and it's billed as he's going to speak for an hour and a half, and the tickets are a buck, although they're cheaper, and there are cheaper seats, but it's still, it's not a cheap show. And he's ticked the locals off because he's written this thing, so it's not clear what he's going to do. And the reviews are mixed. Some people say, you know, the house was packed, and it was great. And some say, you know, I questioned the value of my dollar when it was over. And another one says he only spoke for an hour. He's supposed to speak for an hour and a half. But they mentioned that the local paper that reviews it said, I got to admit, I laughed a lot. Everybody else was laughing. It was really funny. And one of the best jokes was the one he played on Professor Simmons. I thought that was hilarious. They don't tell us what that is, at least in that one. Mm-hmm. I found another newspaper report that says that part of the joke was that they claim that this was a rumor that everybody in town knew that Simmons had fallen in love with the Mormon girl, and that Hingston and Artemus Ward, you know, wrote a letter and got a girl to write a letter and perfume it and say, you know, meet me in this spot at this time. And he got all dudded up and then they, you know, made fun of him or something. And so there's a rivalry going on there. They're rooming in the same hotel, possibly even in the same room, according to one account. But there's a, you know, and it could be a fake rivalry to sell tickets, you know, controversy sells. Mm-hmm. But so they give theirs. They live town, and Ward has 4 days to get back at them. And in fact, they on Monday night is when that performance is giving, and they leave town, I think, on Wednesday. So they stick around a day or two, and they leave heading further east. They're they're going to do a show in Denver, and in mining towns in between. So Thursday night, Simmons gives his show, and the church records, because it was a church-owned property, it says in their handwritten ledger, Professor Simmons performed his legerdemain crowded. So he sold the place out. He did really well. They don't say that. They say Artemus Ward gave his lecture. They don't comment on how many people are there. He records, Artemus Ward, Hingston says they only, because he was disappointed after their experience in California, this is a huge theater, they only made $490. Still a huge amount at the time, but given how much they were making in California, they were disappointed. And Artemus Ward gives a whole list of, because they cash was in very short supply, probably nationwide, but particularly in Utah, especially greenbacks. They didn't have currency.
They used gold, I guess.
They could, but they could also accept other forms of payment. So Ward says he got, you know, 5 bushels of corn, 2 bushels of wheat, a live pig. Someone tried to give them a half-breed dog. They wouldn't take that. He got some baby clothes. You know, there's a whole list of these weird things
just
he
bartered.
Got. On the program, the playbill, the advertising Professor Simmons, it says at the bottom, cash and grain only. I think he didn't want any baby clothes or doll clothes or whatever it was, baby's underwear. But he obviously did well because it was crowded. But, you know, there were other ways of payment people could make. I have a later magician who comes through there, Professor Heller, who, with Brigham Young's encouragement, as Heller tells it, he accepted a load of manure as partial payment. And then now he's got, you know, he's done. He's leaving. What does he do with the manure? He doesn't want to take it over the mountains to California. So he sells it back to Brigham Young. And you know, Brigham Young made a profit on both ends, but it was apparently always, you know, excellent fertilizer in the desert at the time was quite valuable,
sure,
but it wasn't something you wanted to cross the mountains to California with.
That's a weird payment. Okay.
Yeah. That isn't until like 1867, but he was the last big one before the trains came through. Anyway, so apparently the paper in reviewing Simmons' performance says it was wonderful. He did some amazing things, but they say perhaps not the least good thing he did was his opening monologue, which we'll quote here. And it's a whole thing about Artemus Ward. And he says, you know, I'm not going to give you a lecture. And people go nuts. Thank God. We just heard one the other night. We don't want another lecture. And he said, no, I'm going to give you the birth of your money. And tremendous applause. And he apparently, according to Simmons writing it up in a later autobiography that he wrote back in England, he was performing under a different name by then, he says that in his performance, his lecture, the joke on him was that Artemus Ward said, oh, man, you know, what you saw him do after Othello, that's nothing compared to what he can really do. Man, I saw him swallow a pole. I saw him climb up a pole and then swallow it up after him. That sounds a lot like the ads we just read, stuff exactly. He couldn't possibly do. Right. So I think that's the joke. Hingston and Ward put these fake ads in the paper to try and get people all excited, and then they'd go to a show and like, you didn't do the thing I saw in the paper. Yeah. What, I want my money back. I think that was their practical joke part of it. Mm-hmm. And then there was also this woman thing maybe worked into it. So in the newspaper review, quoting the monologue that was very successful in Simmons' show, he says that at the performance the other night, Artemus Ward alluded to my losing my head, because one of his big features that he advertised, usually for the closing night only, was he would cut off his head and carry it under his arm. Mm-hmm. Apparently a black art thing, and probably not a very good trick, which is probably why he'd save it till he was ready to leave town. But he had trick photographs made that are, it's cut off under his arm. It looks pretty impressive.
Is that the one from the posters that we've seen, that, or is that Keller?
Probably a different one. Okay. Probably a different one. But these were taken in Australia in 1862 or early 63. I think early 63. At the start of his Australian tour, and they look impressive, but they're, you know, a modern version of Photoshop. Not the real trick in progress. But that was his big advertising thing. Final performance, come see the head cut under the arm. So that was a known piece that he did. The newspaper said maybe he'll cut off his arm. We'll have to go and see. Apparently he didn't. It's not mentioned in the review. But he says, you know, Artemus Ward, when he was talking about me, said that when I was in Africa, and one of Artemus Ford's famous lecture was 60 Minutes in Africa, where he doesn't talk about Africa at all until the end when he looks at his watch. So, I'll look in the encyclopedia if you want to know about Africa. So he was known for that. So he says, Artemus Ward talked about how my head got cut off in Africa and it didn't come back to me with the States. And that was partly part of his joking. So he says, that's true. I happened to be in Africa when Artemus Ward was in Africa, and I cut off both our heads. And when we left to come back, we had forgotten them, and when we sent for them, mine came back fine. His was missing the brain, and that explains that talk he gave the other night, and everybody goes nuts. And it says in the newspaper, 5 minutes of pandemonium before he could calm the crowd down again. They loved it because he's attacking the guy who had attacked them, kind of. So big success. Anyway, there are a couple – so that part is pretty much documented. Years later, Simmons is performing – successfully under a different name, a name you may have heard of because it's another factor and more famous in magic literature. He was performing under the name Dr. Lin. Apparently his real name was Simmons, but he was performing as Dr. Lin. And that's a footnote to magic history, because Houdini, in writing up his own life, says that his father took him to a theater, I guess in Milwaukee, to see Dr. Lin, and he did this trick palingenesia where a guy gets his arm and leg cut off, and it terrified young Houdini. He thought it was really happening, mm-hmm. but it was also probably the first magician that he remembers seeing. Now, current contemporary scholarship has not found a performance of Dr. Lin in Milwaukee that fits that timeline. So probably Houdini's memory is either a false one, a mistaken one, or he saw someone pretending to be the famous Dr. Lin, who wasn't the real Dr. Lin performing in Milwaukee. But he's kind of a footnote to magic history because of this inspiration with Houdini. But he was very famous in England for a number of tricks they did, including this palingenesia, which they recreated at one of the history conferences a couple of years ago, and it was pretty neat. And they had Jonathan Levitt as Jonathan Levitt was the victim, and the young actor from
Steve
Doogie
Valentine.
Hauser. Who's Doogie Hauser, MD?
Neil Patrick.
Neil Patrick. He was the surgeon who did the cutting, and it was very effective trick. Anyway, so that was something that Dr. Lin was famous for. So as Dr. Lin, he sold, you know, booklets at his show touting, you know, here's my life story. It was called The Adventures of the Strange Man. He's the strange man. Mm-hmm. And he talks about going to Utah and doing these shows, and talks about Hingston and Artemus Ward and how they became buddies, and they've designed this program for him.
Right.
And he reprints the program, not the program that I read to you, but the actual program that designed, which is, I can read that to you too. It's like 13 of these tricks, and they're real tricks.
They're
in a language that if you know the trick, you know what they're talking about. But if you don't, you just wonder, well, I better go to the theater and see that.
Yes.
As opposed to these totally impossible ones that are just bizarre.
It made no sense.
Yeah. So, but he tells several stories about things that happened there, both him and Artemus Ward. And the one that I got interested in is he tells a story about having a private meeting with Brigham Young in his office. Well, he, not him privately, it's Hingston. Ward and he are invited to visit Brigham Young at his home or his offices. And while they're there, Simmons starts doing magic for Brigham the prophet, Young. Brigham Young. And he's fascinated by it, as you would hope. And but he had a habit of standing with one leg bent at the knee on a chair, and the other leg is supporting him. So the leg that's bent at the knee, the sole is exposed. And then when he gets tired on that leg, he'd shift leg and put the other leg on the chair, and
that's
other heel would be exposed.
Okay.
This is Dr. Lynn, formerly Professor Simmons, telling this story. And he says, Hingston, seeing this, got an idea for a practical joke. And keeping in mind that Simmons' big trick was the blood red riding. So he says that Simmons says Hingston took a pen from the desk behind them that had red ink on it, and he writes on the heel of one of the boots, Simmons.
Yeah.
And then the legs shift, and he writes Simmons on the other heel.
Yeah.
And then goes back to watching the performance, you know, because Brigham Young doesn't notice this because he's watching the magic. And apparently Simmons doesn't know this, he says, until Hingston tells it about it as they're leaving. And he says, oh, don't tell anybody. I got a great idea. So the next morning he makes an urgent request to meet with the prophet on a serious matter. Okay, what's the deal? And he says, my boots, I can't find them. I was here yesterday, and when I got home, I didn't have them. And and Brigham Young goes, well, what do you think we are, lost and found? Well, it's not my problem. What's the deal? What did they look like? And he says, well, actually, they look exactly like the boots you're wearing right now. And Brigham Young says, there's no way. These are patent leather boots that were specially designed to my specific proportions. There's not another pair like them in the entire territory of Utah. There's no way these are your boots. And so Simmons says, well, easy to check. Mine have my name written on the bottom of them. And so Brigham Young says, that is easy to check, takes one off and turns it over. And according to Simmons, who's the only source for this story, his jaw drops and he says, you know, puts the other leg across his foot, sees the name there. And then he goes off on this tirade. He says, you are a miracle worker. If I could convert you to our faith, you could work wonders. I'd make you a high priest. I'd give you three of my daughters in marriage. And if in 3 months' time you do as great as I think you will, you can have as many daughters as you want. And so that's the story that got me kind of interested. Is that even possibly true? He has another couple of good ones. At the performance, Brigham Young would show up with his family, and so many of his children and many of his wives, and he would sit in a rocking chair in the parquet, kind of close to the front of the stage to have the best seats, and rock back and forth and watch it, and wore a top hat to the performances. And in his performance, according to Simmons, he was going to do the growth of the tree under a hat. So he had some he called it mold, but it'd be some, you know, coffee grounds or something that looked like dirt, and he'd cover it with a borrowed hat, and then he'd lift it and there'd be a little sprout, and then, you know, more of the tree would grow up. So he was going to do that trick, and so he borrows Brigham Young's hat because he's got this big top hat, and he says, as he carries it back to the stage, when he arrives on stage, he looks in it, and then he looks at Brigham Young and says, are you married? Well, everybody knew Brigham Young was multiply married, and so that gets a laugh, and Brigham Young gets a bigger laugh because he says, I'm rather married. And then Simmons says, well, I think you left this in the hat, reaches in the hat, and pulls out a live baby and hands it to him. It's like, that really happened? That's a great story, you know, and it's possible you could do that with a little advanced preparation. But none of the newspapers mention it. It's not, you know, written up elsewhere. His claim in telling the story about the boots is that, you know, he was sorely tempted by the offer of the prophet, all these sure. Young girls and other enticements, but he struggled with his conscience and then left town. And he claims that he heard that after he left town, Brigham Young gave a sermon at the tabernacle and thanked the Lord for having rid the community of the devil, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's true, but I think it's a great story. And I just last week tracked down a pair of Brigham Young's boots. I got permission to examine them. I can give you a picture to put on the website if you're interested. And they let me turn them over and look. And I was like, man, if it says Simmons, this is unbelievable. Yeah. You know, case closed.
And
they didn't. There was no writing on them. But these are boots that they believe he was wearing when he entered Salt Lake Valley for the first time in 1847. I'm sure through his life, he went through many pairs of boots.
Of course.
These are boots he would have been wearing if there's any truth to the story at all, in 1864, the boots I saw were not what I would describe as patent leather, nice leather boots, but I don't think they'd fit the description of patent leather. And they have a very curved bottom where it would have been very hard to ride them. But the whole story, well, what are the odds that he'd have red ink, you know, at the handy? And this guy was known for the blood red riding.
Right.
And but it's a fun story, and I'm looking now for more pairs of boots. So I'm giving a talk in about 2 weeks that I think I'm going to call it Brigham's Boots and the Basilicontometrist, or How the Prestidigitator Pranked the Prophet. that's my proposed title.
The blood red boots.
The blood red boots. We can get more bees in there with the blood red boots. Yeah,
exactly.
So
As we start to wrap up over here, that I assume that you are following Simmons for the rest of his career.
No,
I'm only in Utah.
I'm a friend of mine who's a terrific scholar, Dean Arnold, who lived for many years in England, is now back in the States, has been pursuing Dr. Lin research for many years and is writing a book about him, which I'm not sure what his publishing schedule is, but my interest was in this specific incident, and partly because my great-great-grandfather was manager of the theater at the time,
I
could get family diaries saying, yeah, I saw the blood red boots or something. I haven't had those that kind of a breakthrough, but I'm specifically interested in that. But it's a fascinating career, and I'm very excited about Dean Arnold's book when it comes out, and he will probably have a different perspective on this whole story.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. I know that you're going to be finding something else interesting all the time.
My research will be available in the next issue of Gibbousière, I guess the summer 2019 issue, as Stephen Minch is laying it out right now. So if people are interested in the details of that story, get the next issue of Gibbousière.
And where can they find it?
ConjuringArts, is it .org or .com? Either one probably takes you to it, but it's Bill Kalusha's great resource on magic history, and that's a wonderful publication. They Ask Alexander is part of that project, and I got a lot of terrific research out of that.
Excellent. Well, as we're going to start to wrap up over here, let me just quickly ask about the Hatch Academy. Since you moved to Utah,
we'll talk about that a little bit.
Rosemary,
we got just a
brief amount of time.
Okay. So, Rosemary and I decided to move to Utah in 2010 in the fall. And one of the decisions, and it's to be close to my parents. It's Logan, Utah is a college town in northern Utah. Utah State University is there. My dad was on the faculty for many years, first as a physics professor, then for a while as graduate dean of the graduate school, and then back to physics again. And we decided to move there as my parents got older to help them out. My dad had Alzheimer's at that point and has since passed away, and so we just wanted to be there as a resource and to be helpful. And we're very glad we did. But the problem was, how do we make a living in a small college town in northern Utah?
Right.
You know, I kind of knew how things worked in Houston, big town, a lot of opportunities, both as a performing magician and the bookselling business was based there. And I decided not to take the book business with me. Just kind of a midlife crisis, looking for a change. I didn't want to take all those books. You know, they're heavy and they're hard to move. But in theory, I could have, because it's a mail order business primarily. You can do that wherever there's FedEx and UPS and USPS. I just didn't want to. So at that point, Charlie and I sold the retail part of the book business to Marshall Peterson, who had been for an extended period one of our employees, a manager of the shop, and doing all the heavy lifting for us for probably a year or two. So he took over that business. Charlie kept the publishing business, because at some point we started out selling used books and new books, and then we published a book on contact cold reading, or contact mind reading, not cold reading, contact mind reading by Satori, a German mentalist, really good. And then that led to a number of other projects, a Paul Patassi book that I translated, a whole series that Charlie's doing now of Nick Trost books. We did our two bestsellers were the two Darren Brown books.
You finally had to take them out of print.
We kept printing and reprinting and reprinting, and he finally, when we started, he was unknown, really. And then he became a huge star, deservedly so. He's fantastic.
And
he decided those people that needed his book had it by then. They'd had their chance, and he didn't need the money anymore like he did when we first started publishing it. The first editions he published himself in the UK.
He sold 9,000 copies or something.
Something incredible. Yeah. Probably put my daughter through college, theory. that and the Sponge Bunnies. But
so you were in Utah, and so with the Hatch Academy.
So my wife is a violinist, and I knew that she wouldn't have that many performing opportunities in that community as she would in Houston, but she should be able to find students if they knew she was there, given her background and talents, resume. How do you get that word out there? Well, violinist moves to town. That's not really a news story. But you open a school of magic and music. Now, that's interesting. And I put out a press release saying, you know, dubbed by the press, a combination of Hogwarts and Juilliard. And, man, they ate it up. It was, we had a great grand opening. And it backfired for a little while. And I initially had more students than she did. That didn't last very long. And, you know, she's got 30 students. I've got two, you know, that kind of situation. And hers come every week and practice their scales and things. And my come every couple of months to work on cups and balls or linking rings or something they know I do that they want to learn.
Right.
It's a more specific. But it's great. We're in an old mansion built in the 1870s. It's owned by the city of Logan. It's
and you still do your chamber magic shows?
We occasionally do. We used to do them fairly regularly in that venue. We haven't done them there in a long time, but we do like to do it, and we'll do it at private events.
So people are going to be traveling up to Salt Lake City and with Logan.
Yeah, we're about an hour and a half north, about 80 miles
north. They should
north
check
of Salt
the website
Lake.
To see if you're going to be having a public
show. Yeah, I try to. I haven't updated in a while, but I will be doing a performance on Valentine's Day, not with the piano and violin, just by myself at a bed and breakfast in my town that I live in, which is called Providence, a suburb, if you will, of Logan.
Yeah.
It's a historic location, and that's, they should.
And that's hatchacademy.com.
Hatchacademy.com. You can keep up with me there.
Well, as we wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Words. What is your philosophy of life? What's your...
Oh, my gosh, I should know that from having listened to your philosophy. Okay, I'm gonna go lazy, but one of my favorite quotes on that topic is from one of my favorite musicians, kind of heroes, John Lennon, who said, life is what happens while you're making other plans. And that's kind of the story of my life. None of this has been planned. I don't know how I got here. I'm kind of happy where I am, but I wouldn't have known I was going there till I got there.
And you're glad you got there.
I'm glad I got there.
Well, I'm glad you got here with me.
Yeah, me too. That was fun.
I had a chance to finally sit down and have a good long chat.
Sure.
That's great. I'm sure everybody enjoyed it and learned a lot there too. Wow. Interesting stuff. Fascinating. Yeah, there's so many more things we can talk about historically having to do with magic. And if this is something, by the way, that you listeners are tuned to this and would like to hear more, that I'd be glad to talk to Dick on some other topics and other people, perhaps some historians, if this is the direction you kind of like to go, that I like to add these from time to time. But we have such a varied group of speakers and friends here that come to the microphone and share this. So thanks for sitting down and sharing
some
time
it.
With me.
My pleasure. Thanks,
Scott. Over the Magic Word Podcast. That was Richard Hatch. This is Scotty out. Well, thank you, Richard. It was always great talking with you, and I had a great time and learned a lot as well about some historical facts that were not only interesting to me, but completely unknown. I didn't know anything about the Plains Magicians over there, and also about Artemus Ward and his relationship with Mark Twain and Abraham Lincoln and everything else. Wow, that was fascinating stuff, and I appreciate you enlightening us, and I enjoyed last week's podcast when we chatted with Richard also and talking about his search for S.W. Erdnase, the mysterious author of Expert at the Card Table. And so that was just equally as wonderful, and I hope that you guys have enjoyed this. As I mentioned towards the end of the podcast, if these kinds of historical conversations are things that you enjoy, please let me know. If it's not, then let me know that then also. If there is something that's a direction that you'd like to see these podcasts go in the future, or if you kind of like them the way they are, I kind of bounce all over the board as far as one week to the next as to who we're going to be talking with and the conversations that we will have. And you'll be, I think, very interested in some of the people we have coming up in future weeks. And for you to know who's going to be coming from week to week, then there's no better way than to find out than to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, where I will tell you who it is that is on the podcast released that day, and then also who's on deck coming up then the following week, plus some suggestions for some of the conversations we've had from the archives you may have missed, but certainly is worth another listen if you have already heard those. So those are some good reasons why you should sign up for the newsletter, and I appreciate everyone who has signed up, and I hope that you're enjoying them. And also that I want to remind everybody that if you use Amazon.com to purchase anything, please help the Magic Word. If you'll just go down to the bottom, scroll down to the bottom of any page on the Magic Word, and you will see on the website there'll be a link that'll say Amazon Affiliate. Click on that, and it will take you to Amazon where you can open your account, you can look at your account, whatever. But the point is that by going through that link, then as an affiliate, that we get a little bit of help back from Amazon. For every little penny that you spend there, we get a fraction of that then as well. So thank you guys very much much for your support, and thank you for listening. And next week is going to be an exciting guest. And if you are on the newsletter subscription list, then you know who's coming. And I know you're going to enjoy this one also. But until next week, stay well, get booked. And as John Lennon had said, life is what happens when you're busy making plans. So don't let life slip away while you're making those plans. This is Scotty out.